Hello and welcome to Chalk Talk. Today we have Gareth Davies talking about African-American civil rights.
My name's Gareth Davies and I teach American history at Oxford University, and what I'm going to talk to you today is about African-American civil rights. And what I'm particularly interested in is a regime of race relations that was called Jim Crow. It came into being at the end of the 19th century and it lasted until the 1960s. What I want to talk about mainly is its demise, how it came to an end. But let me start by just offering you a few brief thoughts as to how we might define this system of Jim Crow, because it's not quite as straightforward as one might think. On the face of it, this label Jim Crow, it describes a system of law and regulation that's based on separation of blacks and whites. Not in every walk of life, but in many walks of life. So in schools, in hotels, in cinemas, in public accommodations, in parks. Now it's based on an idea of separate but equal, that while facilities are meant to be separate, they're supposed to be equal. The reason for that is the US Constitution. The 14th Amendment to the Constitution, which was passed during the Reconstruction era after the Civil War, said that all African Americans born in the United States had the same rights of citizenship as did white Americans, and that they were entitled to equal protection of the law. So the architects of Jim Crow knew that they had to design a system of racial regulations that comported in theory with the Constitution and with the 14th Amendment. However, in reality, as I'm sure you know, separate but equal was just a veneer, or the equal bit of it was just a veneer. That in reality, this was a regime not fundamentally about separation, but about subjugation. Jim Crow laws were enacted by white people to subjugate black people. So it's a system of racial subjugation, but it's also a regime of terror. Okay? So the fact that Jim Crow is defined by a series of laws and regulations shouldn't blind us to the fact that actually it's enforced in quite substantial measure through violence, through tyranny, or through economic intimidation. But it's not simply, or even maybe primarily, about laws. One other definitional point I want to make to you. Jim Crow is one particular instance of a broader phenomenon, that if you look at the history of American race relations from the 17th century right through until recent times, we might say that it is characterized by a series of regimes of racial subjugation. First, and most obviously, enslavement from the early 17th century through until the Civil War. Second, during the period immediately after the end of slavery, racial subordination was enforced to quite a substantial degree, I would say, by terror, by terrorism, by violence, or by the threat of violence. So that we might describe as a second regime of racial subjugation. And then third, starting really in the 1890s, we have this particular regime that I'm interested in called Jim Crow. But we shouldn't exaggerate the degree to which Jim Crow is unique or particular. It is a particular version, but of a broader phenomenon that has run throughout American history. So let's start by just thinking a little bit about some of the factors that helped to sustain this system of racial segregation. Because if you think about it, there's probably no other political system in the history of the world that has had, in formal terms, a greater commitment to the idea of individual liberty, starting with the Declaration of Independence. So it's incongruous that this, it's superficially surprising that this kind of, not that racism should have existed, but that a system of racial subjugation that was so obviously at odds with the Constitution and with this ostensible commitment to liberty should have stayed in place for 60 or 70 years. I think the first point to make is that although the system of Jim Crow is peculiar to the American South, the racial attitudes, the white racial attitudes that are responsible for it are more widespread than that. Okay, they're racial attitudes that you would have found throughout the nation. We shouldn't exaggerate the degree to which Jim Crow is a result of peculiarly Southern attitudes. Rather, it's a result of the fact that the great majority of African Americans live in the South, and that the South was characterized by a very particular form of agrarian plantation agriculture. Okay, but actually, there's no fundamental difference between the way Northern whites and Southern whites viewed African Americans. If we think about the 19th century and the slave era, this may surprise you, but opposition to slavery before the Civil War was driven less by sympathy for African Americans than by fear of African Americans. Many of those who supported anti-slavery in the Whig Party or the Republican Party before the Civil War, the reason why they wanted to contain slavery and not allow it to spread was because they didn't want competition from black labor and they didn't want African Americans as neighbors, okay? So it was actually white hostility to African Americans rather than sympathy that really did most to explain white opposition to the spread of slavery outside of its existing bounds. So, secondly, if we think about the United States as a nation of immigrants, I'm sure you know that the United States is a settler nation. Everyone who lived there had come ultimately from somewhere else. There was a tremendous tendency within the United States during the 19th century to make distinctions along ethno-racial lines. So in a way, the way that African Americans were viewed with whites was an extreme version of a broader tendency to distinguish different groups of Americans according to where they came from or what color they were. One nice example of just how embedded racial attitudes were throughout the nation would be Franklin Roosevelt. Franklin Roosevelt was president of the US during the Great Depression, and he was from New York State. And he is really the patron saint of modern American liberalism, seen as a key exponent of the idea of creating a more equal society. But Franklin Roosevelt was born in the 1880s. Franklin Roosevelt came of age in an era when the United States, like European nations, was acquiring a substantial non-white empire, in the case of the United States, in the Philippines, in Puerto Rico. Franklin Roosevelt took it for granted that African Americans were not as good as whites. I don't think it ever occurred to him that there was anything wrong with segregation. He didn't support lynching, but he had absolutely no problem with the idea that it made sense to separate the races because African Americans were not as good as whites. Okay? So it's really important that you should understand, and it's quite hard for us, I think, living in the 21st century, to sort of look back to an era when you could be regarded as a very modern, very enlightened person, but you adhered unthinkingly to these kinds of racial stereotypes. Okay, they were ubiquitous until the era of World War II. So that's one of the things that sustains Jim Crow, that it's not just a series of Southern attitudes. Secondly, and this is something that people often don't grasp, but the US has a federal system of government, right? That means that power is divided between the center in Washington, D.C., and then the individual states, right? So the US Constitution was set up by people who really distrusted concentrated power. They sought to make government difficult. They sought to make the exercise of power by the central government particularly difficult. So even if you live in a world in which racism is peculiar to this particular region, actually tackling that in political terms is difficult within the context of the American system of government. The third point I would make is to do with the particular character of the South, that the South was the most rural part of the United States, and African Americans in the South mostly lived in very, very remote circumstances. That really matters in terms of forming a sense of community, in terms of developing a shared sense of injustice that can translate into effective resistance to racial subjugation. If we look, as I'm going to do in a minute, about the period when African-American resistance to Jim Crow starts to become really effective, a lot of the impetus comes from African-Americans who are A, middle class, have some economic security, B, have some education, and C, live in towns or cities, right? So Martin Luther King's dad, who was, like his son, a Baptist minister, was actually a very wealthy man in an area of Atlanta called Auburn. It was known as Sweet Auburn, which is a line from a poem by Goldsmith. And he had a degree of economic independence. He'd had the chance to get a good education. He lived in a kind of cosmopolitan environment. Most African Americans did not. They were poor. They had very little schooling, and they lived a long way from their neighborhood. John Lewis, who is a real modern-day hero of civil rights, he is a congressman from Atlanta today. In his memoir, he talks about the fact that he lived in an area that was so remote that he never saw his neighbors except when they went to church every Sunday. So in that kind of environment, you can imagine how difficult it was, even if you really feel a burning sense of injustice, how difficult it would be to act on that. The final thing I would say about what sustains Jim Crow is it kind of sustains itself. I don't know if any of you have ever come across a very famous book by a guy called C. Van Woodward, which is called The Strange Career of Jim Crow. But Woodward argues that when Jim Crow came about, he thinks it was quite new, but that after all of these regulations and laws had been passed over a period of about a quarter of a century, it just suddenly came to seem normal, like it had always been this way, even though in reality it hadn't. So processes like this can sometimes take on a momentum of their own. Okie dokie, so what was it in the first instance that started to destabilize this system of Jim Crow? The way I want you to think about this is a way that you will probably find useful in other contexts as a historian. It's often very useful when you're trying to understand powerful forces of social change to distinguish between factors that make it possible and then factors that actually serve to be sparks of change. Okay, so I'm thinking here about difference between background forces and actual sparks of change. So in terms of what destabilized Jim Crow, in the first instance, it is black resistance. Okay, there had always been black resistance to racial subjugation going back to the slave era. This is something you probably have encountered in your reading. It's the way historians are writing about slavery and race now, in a way that they didn't used to, that when Martin Luther King or Rosa Parks are leading protest, they are inheritors of a long tradition of protest rather than creating something that is brand new. So that's one precondition for destabilizing and overturning this system. Second, because of economic change in the South and because of patterns of urbanization, and because, for example, of the growing amount of federal dollars that are being invested in the South during the New Deal, during the 1930s, and then during World War II, with the growing number of federal military bases in places like South Carolina and Mississippi. There's a lot of new money coming into the South. The South, by the 1940s, is a lot less economically backward than it had been at the start of the century. And more African Americans are moving to towns. There are more African Americans who are having some sort of opportunity to earn money and to gain an education. The third factor that I think is really important is World War II and the Holocaust, and the fact that Allied participation in World War II, it was not just a war against Germany and her allies, but it was a war against Nazism, and Nazism was an idea that was defined in substantial measure by racial ideology. I think it's really important for you to take this on board, that while racism persisted after World War II, it ceased to be intellectually reputable. Okay? So that's the difference between, say, someone like Franklin Roosevelt, who's president during the 1930s and then during World War II, and who's a product of the late 19th century, and someone like Earl Warren, who's a generation younger and who you may know of as the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court at the time of the Brown v. Board of Education decision in 1954. So Earl Warren, his attitudes to race are influenced in part by the fact that he is coming of political age in an era when the United States is fighting Nazism and fighting race thinking. But probably the larger impact of World War II is on African Americans who participate in World War II, who are fighting for liberties that they do not possess at home. So I've just mentioned Brown versus Board of Education, which is a Supreme Court decision that outlaws racial segregation in schools. It is one of six Supreme Court decisions that were handed down at the same time in 1954. And Oliver Brown, who was from Topeka, Kansas, was the parent of a girl called Linda Brown. And Oliver Brown was a World War II veteran. Five of the six lead plaintiffs, the people who put their name to these six cases, were World War II veterans. One of them was a guy called Briggs. He was a farmer in South Carolina. He fought in World War II. He came back to Summerfield, South Carolina, and a representative of the NAACP came knocking on his door. The NAACP was the leading black civil rights organization. And this guy, he said, "Mr. Briggs, will you put your name to this case that we're bringing before the Supreme Court that will allow your daughter to attend an integrated school?" And he said yes. What happened next was that his house was firebombed. And then he lost his job. And then he and his wife were forced to flee the state. And this was not a big surprise, but he did it anyway. So why did he do it anyway? And why were people not doing that to the same degree in the early 20th century? I would say that by the 1940s and 1950s, the world had moved sufficiently that if you made a gesture like this, although you knew you were taking a big risk, it wasn't the kind of empty gesture that it would have been 30 years, 40 years before. So I think that World War II context is very important. However, it remained the case that within the South, there were very, very few whites who could yet conceive of the idea of sharing political power. with African Americans, okay? So racism has been destabilized at an elite level. African Americans who have been inspired in part by World War II and who are now living in a somewhat more affluent and urban environment can start to conceive of mobilizing against this system to a greater degree, but white resistance in the South remains very strong. Okay, so for this to be destabilized is going to require pressure, not just from African Americans in the South, but from outside, okay, from outside the South. The really important thing for you to bear in mind in that context is the growth of the federal government during the 1930s and 1940s. Do you remember I said that during the New Deal under Franklin Roosevelt and during World War II, millions of federal dollars are being pumped into the South? That gives the federal government potential new leverage, right? You'd better desegregate your schools or we turn off the tap. No more federal dollars for you. It gives the federal government a sort of leverage it hadn't had before. Another great consequence of World War II is that many African Americans move north. The Great Black Migration wasn't new, but it gains momentum during the 1940s. Until World War II, 80% of African Americans live in the South. After World War II, you have very large black communities in places like Chicago, Philadelphia, New York, Milwaukee, across the North, especially in cities. What matters there is these African Americans have moved from places where they can't vote to places where they can vote. Harry Truman, when he's re-elected in 1948, which was the greatest surprise result in presidential history until recently, he wouldn't have been re-elected had it not been for support from African Americans. So African Americans have new political leverage, right, after World War II because of that migration. Another factor, until World War II, the cotton plantation system on which large parts of the South depended relied very, very heavily on unskilled labor. After World War II, it becomes mechanized very suddenly, very quickly. One of the things that had impelled Southern whites to keep African Americans in a condition almost akin to servitude had been the economic need to have a servile, uneducated labor force that would pick the weeds and harvest the cotton and plant the cotton. That imperative no longer exists after World War II. Now, here's something that's maybe less obvious, but I think is very important. Think about the impact of modernization in cultural terms, right? By the 1950s, wherever you live in the United States, you're watching the same movies, you have the same sports icons, you're listening to the same sort of music, you're watching the same shows on TV. One of the most important elements in modern life, I would say, is the rise of a more homogeneous, a more shared national culture that breaks down localism, okay? So the South is becoming less Southern in a way. It's becoming more like the rest of the nation, not just in economic terms, in that rates of education are higher, more people are living in cities, but in cultural terms as well. And then the final kind of contextual factor is the background of the Cold War. Americans during the Cold War are fighting what is largely an ideological war with international communism. And when there are racial outrages in the South that are completely at odds with American principles, that is extremely embarrassing for the United States in a Cold War context, especially if you think about the fact that this is the era of decolonization throughout Africa, throughout Asia, throughout the South Pacific. So if you think about something like the Birmingham protests of 1963. You've maybe seen these iconic images of white cops with electric cattle prods and fire hoses and Alsatians attacking black children. Yeah? It's morally discomforting, but also, what are the Soviet Union going to do with this? On Radio Moscow, they will be beaming shows to places like Ghana and Kenya, saying, in the United States, with its grandiose claims to representing liberty, four African-American school children were killed by a bomb while attending Sunday school in Alabama yesterday. What does that do for the United States' Cold War prospects? If you've got decolonizing countries deciding which way are we going to go? Are we going to go to the United States or are we going to go with the Soviet Union? So civil rights, you need to think about it in those sort of international terms as well. But also think of the inspiration that African Americans get from decolonization. That's important as well. So all of these things that I've just been talking about mean that Jim Crow, by the end of the 1950s, is a lot less obviously strong than it had been in the early 20th century. But what was it that actually eliminated it, destroyed it? Okay, so it's vulnerable, but it's still there. What is it that finally kills it off? And the answer has in part to do with protest, in part it has to do with broader political change. And what I really want you to understand, has the microphone stopped? Can you hear me? Can you hear me at the back still? Yeah? It feels to me as if my microphone isn't emitting a sound anymore. But what you have to understand is that when the NAACP brings a court case, or when the Civil Rights Act of 1957 is passed, that's not just top-down politics. What matters most about that is the interface between top-down politics and bottom-up community organizing. So let's take Brown v. Board of Education and think about what happens next, right? So the Supreme Court says it is unconstitutional to segregate schools by race. But so what? How is that going to be tested? The way it is tested is in places like Little Rock, Arkansas, where in 1957, nine African-American children integrate the Central High School. Now, their parents have made this incredibly difficult decision that while they love their children and they know what suffering and abuse they are going to endure, they think it is really important that their children should attend this previously all-white school, that they should make a stand. But what they're really doing is they are testing a Supreme Court decision, right? The Supreme Court decision is meaningless unless it's followed up by that bottom-up activity. Another Supreme Court decision said that it was unconstitutional to segregate public transportation. But it doesn't mean a damn thing unless it's tested. 1960, some of you may have heard of the Freedom Rides. A group of whites and blacks get on Greyhound buses in Washington, D.C. and travel to New Orleans. They know that they're going to be attacked, but they do it anyway. But what they are doing is they are testing a Supreme Court decision. So this gesture would be meaningless unless that Supreme Court decision had been made, all right? But it's also meaningless to say, is it top-down action or bottom-up protest that matters most? It's the confluence of the two that matters most. But what also matters is a broader environment of political change. That if you think about the year 1964, when the big Civil Rights Act is passed. It's also the year when Lyndon Johnson, who's president at the time, launches a program that he calls the Great Society. And Lyndon Johnson, he stands in a room like this in front of the graduating class at the University of Michigan, and he says, "We must move onwards and upwards to the Great Society." And it's a remarkably idealistic vision of the future. Ultimately, what makes it possible is prosperity and the fact that the United States had enjoyed extraordinary prosperity since World War II. On the whole, in the United States, freedom struggles do well in an environment where people are not worrying quite so much about where the next meal is going to come from. Okay, so racial freedom struggles and feminism are at a very low ebb in the 1930s. They gain momentum in the 50s and 60s in a context in which people are a bit less bothered about those kind of economic and quantitative issues, thinking a little bit more about qualitative issues, like the environment, for example, like the paradox of poverty amid plenty, but also black civil rights and feminism. They all gain strength in an environment where politicians are a bit less preoccupied than normal with questions like taxation, welfare state, economic prosperity. Right, now, those factors, I think, explain why Jim Crow collapses and why it collapses when it did. What took its place? It's going to be my final point. It's also, though, quite a complicated one, and it's one that we shouldn't be glib about. In 1963, 64, 65, whether you take an African-American like Martin Luther King or whether you take Lyndon Johnson, their rhetoric is suffused with optimism about the future and about the possibility of moving towards a society in which race doesn't matter. Now, if you look at the 50 years since, you have to acknowledge that some fundamental transformations have taken place. Whether you're talking about black political participation, voting, elected officials, House of Representatives, Senate, president, a black president, whether you are looking at the emergence of a big black middle class since the 1960s, whether you're looking at opinion poll data that suggests that white racial attitudes are a lot more liberal than they used to be, or whether you look at the representation of African Americans in popular culture today compared to 50 or 60 years ago, one has to acknowledge that an enormous amount has changed in ways that are consistent with the dreams of Martin Luther King and Lyndon Johnson. On the other hand, it's quite clear that the United States is still a racially polarized society. And I think one reason for that is because the time at which politicians and activists started moving from trying to secure legal rights to trying to secure economic rights was also the time when the wheels fell off the bandwagon of the long economic boom. Okay, so African Americans were trying to win economic freedom, economic equality, in a deteriorating economy. And this increasingly meant that African American gains could only be purchased at white expense. And so you get degrees of hostility between black and whites that arise from the fact that debates about economics, affirmative action, education are being carried out in the context of a declining economy rather than a growing economy. And I think my final point is that while you have the growth of a big black middle class, you've also had the growth in this deteriorating economy of a growing black underclass. And if you look at the United States today, at rates of poverty, at rates of incarceration, then rates of unemployment, then many of them are defined by race to quite a remarkable degree. And that fact makes it very difficult for it makes it harder for whites to imagine African Americans still as being equal to them if their stereotype of an African American is still of someone who is behind bars or who is selling drugs or who is unemployed or is on welfare. The degree to which these social problems are perceived as correlating with race is arguably one of the big barriers now towards moving towards a truly post-racial society.
Well, that's it for today, but there's plenty more for you to enjoy at cvhf.org.uk or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you for listening.